The United States versus King. Mr. Gray.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Frank Gray, court-appointed attorney for Mr. King, and I'm from Fort Wayne, Indiana. What I'm going to attempt to do today is to convince you that I am the reasonable attorney that Judge Flom described when he authored United States versus Alden almost 20 years ago, which deals with issues that we raised in our brief. Mr. King was indicted in February 2001 for distribution of methamphetamine of more than 50 grams but less than 500 grams. The court appointed counsel for him at that time. I was appointed as substitute counsel, which I'll describe in a few more minutes. The case was tried to a jury and to Judge Lee, and the defendant was ultimately sentenced to 262 months in prison. The defendant had filed a motion to retain an expert for fingerprint analysis, which was denied by the court. The purpose of the motion was to examine the plastic bag that the alleged drugs came in to verify the presence or absence of fingerprints of the defendant or of others. The evidence regarding the fingerprints was crucial to the defendant's case because he denied participating in the hand-to-hand purchase and alleged that he was being set up. In the face of the government's testimony about the events of the sale, he needed to have some corroboration for his position that he had not touched the packet. Enter the reasonable attorney. At the time of my appointment, Judge Lee said to review all of the pending motions because the defendant had also filed motions on his own behalf throughout the case together with his previous court-appointed counsel. And the judge instructed me to evaluate those motions, determine whether any motions in addition needed to be filed, and then to either adopt or modify or agree or withdraw motions that I didn't feel had any credibility. In our appendix at King, page 9, is the motion to adopt slash amend prior pleadings that I had filed with the court on April 25th, 2002. And on the second page of that pleading at King 10, I indicated to the court that on September 17th, 2001, before I had appeared in the case, the defendant had filed a motion to retain an expert for fingerprint analysis of the government's plastic bag. I then went on to indicate that we wanted to renew or to further that request for the purpose of examining the plastic bag, and that I made the specific request for the judge to grant that motion. The judge had previously taken the motion under advisement, as the government's brief correctly points out. I was new counsel at that point, and pursuant to the judge's order, I felt that this was a legitimate motion to be considered by the court and hopefully granted to have Criminal Justice Act funds approved so that some defense could be prepared for the defendant. I felt at the time that by making that motion that I was acting as a reasonable attorney when faced with the facts of the case, and that the fingerprint expert was important as previously requested, but the judge denied the motion. Now, as it relates to the reasonable attorney, Judge Flom, as you described in your United States versus Alden, and I'll talk about the cases since it's a little daunting having you on the panel, and Judge Mannion also had authored United States versus Cravens, and so those are important cases to the issue that I'm raising today, I believe. I've been appointed on the case after the case had been pending for 13 months. Pretrial motions had been filed, an evidentiary hearing was held. The defendant had claimed bad communications with his prior counsel, and after I sat down and explained the various legal theories available, including what entrapment was, as opposed to alleging that he had been set up, the defendant indicated that he denied the charges in the indictment. So I then reviewed the facts of the case, and it was clear.
That was why there was a change in strategy, because you came in.
Yes, ma'am.
So that was withdrawn.
Yes, that's correct, Judge. After reviewing the facts of the case, and as the government points out in their brief, and in reading their brief, it's like reliving the case again, but the allegations was that there was a task force agent who made a hand-to-hand buy in a car with the defendant, There was testimony that there was a confidential informant seated in the car as well, observing what was happening. There was testimony that there were five or six different surveillance agents seeing the defendant walk from his car over to the car where the alleged transaction took place. There were at least three officers who then testified later on that they had discussed with the defendant his arrest, Mirandized him, and that he admitted his conduct. The defendant then, as I proceed to interview him and say, okay, where are we with this, and we have to proceed, says that he wants to go to trial, that he didn't do it, that he wants to have a jury trial, and that the other witnesses were not telling the truth, that he was being set up, and that he wanted to go forward. At that point, as a reasonable attorney, I felt, okay, what can I do to further the defendant's position in the case and handle my ethical responsibilities as well? Well, one was that I would cross-examine as best I could every government's witness that was introduced, but also I felt that we needed to attempt to corroborate the defendant's position. That is, that he didn't make the transaction, so he didn't touch the packet, so what to do? How to corroborate this? Well, the manner that I chose was to get an expert witness that had previously been requested and have that person examine the packet for the reasons stated in my motion. Now, based on that, the judge denied the motion, so I was left with trying the case with a couple of witnesses who would corroborate the defendant's earlier conduct just briefly, but in no serious respect talk about what happened relating to the allegations of what the government was saying happened as far as the drug transfer. The defendant also, as you know from the brief, had prior felony convictions, so that presented other problems as far as offering him up as a witness, so any corroboration of his version of the fact became crucial to the whole presentation of the case. In that context, then, the law of the circuit, as I acknowledge, Judge Flom, you were the author of Alden and subsequently of case on Goodwin, the question then becomes, and the government points out in their brief, okay, what does a reasonable attorney do, and how far can a reasonable attorney expect to go? I would submit to you, because I had identified what I wanted, that this was not a fishing expedition. All I wanted was get the packet. It was here in the evidence locker in Chicago. Get the packet. Let's have it examined so that I can have some basis for establishing what needed to be established for the defendant's presentation of his case. Based on that, I submit that it was not a fishing expedition, that it was not being requested on the off chance that the services might turn up something, but it was for a specific purpose, which I outlined in my request, which, as I say, was denied. So my suggestion is that...
So what you were hopeful was that it wouldn't show it was his fingerprint and therefore the control by, the jury would find that everybody lied about the control by.
Well, I was hoping for more than that. I was hoping, one, yes, that his fingerprints wouldn't be on it, but that Montgomery's would be, because he said that Montgomery is the one who actually made the transaction. So if Montgomery's fingerprints were on it, the police were saying that Montgomery was not a confidential informant for them, and my client's was not on it, then I would have a closing argument that I really could do with a straight face to a jury to say, okay, explain this away if you are agreeing that these 10 government witnesses are believable and my client is not. So I did not have that opportunity. Now, let me suggest to the court that the Durant decision that I cite from the Second Circuit is not in conflict with what has been decided. And I do point out to Judge Flom, because when I wrote the brief on your decision in Goodwin, actually I overstated it adversely for me, that the decision there was you saying, okay, the attorney who filed the request for an investigator didn't give you any reason, didn't give the court any idea as to what was being sought, and therefore was denied, and legitimately so. So it was not a request for a fingerprint analyst, it was a request, blanket request for an investigator, which didn't even comply with what the section, I believe, required. As it relates to Alden, and Judge, if I might address, I mean to address the entire panel, but Judge Flom also authored Fazzini, which is another case that we refer to. In both of those cases, I think that they are distinguishable from our facts and different from Durant, because those were cases where there was medical evidence already in the record that the judge, in making those determinations, said, well, I've already got a psychiatrist saying that the person was sane, so why are we going to go through jumping hoops on something that has already been decided in my own mind? And Judge Mannion, on Cravens, as I understand your opinion there, the decision, once again, dealing with the request for an expert, that you had said, well, this is for a sentencing purpose where somebody can't even get what they want. They're requesting something that's not even legally allowable, so why should we go through the expense of jumping through those hoops?
You mentioned Fassini. Was that Paul Fassini? Do you know?
That was United States versus Fassini, 871, Fed Second, 635, Your Honor.
No, I just wondered if that was my Paul Fassini in a case I had in the district court.
I can check.
You don't have to do that. I was just looking in the brief. You don't have to do that. Answer Judge Mannion's question.
It was Paul Fassini. Yes, Your Honor.
I just wanted you to cite the Cravens.
I'm sorry?
You cite the Cravens. I was just looking at your table of authority.
Yes, Your Honor. Cravens is 275.
Is it in here?
Fed Third, 637. Yes, Your Honor. It's page 25 of the government's brief.
Oh, government side. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, then. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. So, my point is that of the... I might just close. My point is that of the four cases that have been decided by this circuit that may be anywhere close to dealing with the issues that I have just raised, they can all be reconciled with the request that we have made, and that it was an abuse of discretion for probably the only corroborating evidence that I could have had with my defendant to not allow the fingerprint experts to be retained and to perform those services. And I see I'm out of my time. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Gray.
Yes.
Ms. Hemmings?
Thank you. May it please the court, and it might be appropriate to say good afternoon.
Most appropriate.
We think that quite clearly Judge Lee was acting within his discretion when he denied the request for a fingerprint expert. It seems to us, looking at the fact, that the defendant is forgetting what right he has under Section 3006A. In the brief, in his brief, there's a sentence that seems to suggest that it's an absolute right, and it is not. It's a limited right. The statute itself uses the phrase necessary for an adequate defense. We argued in our brief that there was no plausible defense here. And I think in going back over the facts and over the brief that maybe that was generous. Maybe the court doesn't even have to get to that point. There's a real question as to whether a reasonable private attorney with the facts of this case would even contemplate hiring a fingerprint expert to try to either prove a negative that his client's prints weren't on the bag, or to try to prove up that there was some sort of setup with the CI and Mr. Montgomery, who was the passenger. But looking at the plausible defense test, which is the more limited one, we think that when Judge Lee ruled, he had enough evidence to decide very clearly that there was no plausible defense. The facts were very simple. It was a hand-to-hand buy in a vehicle. There was surveillance, both visual and by the one-way radio. As soon as Mr. King was arrested, well, he left the car where the buy was made. He's arrested on the spot. When he returns to the car, he has the money in his pocket. Not only that, he confesses to the crime. So why would the government need to pay for a fingerprint expert under those circumstances? Judge, we bent over backwards, we believe, with this defendant. There are not many cases where the time that it takes to try the case is less than the time spent in pretrial hearing. Judge Lee listened to Mr. King's argument that he was set up, and that's maybe understandable. There was a CI who turned him in. And Judge Lee authorized the services of an audio expert, two, in fact. And when it turned out that the audio experts could not substantiate King's claim that the tape had been altered, that's really when he started to change his defense to say, oh, it's not a setup, I'm innocent. So we think that clearly the judge was within his discretion. There was basically less than a slim hope here, we think, to obtain anything that would be fruitful. The bottom line is, that's not an absolute right under 306A. With the other issues, I think that we'll just rest on our brief unless the court has any questions.
Apparently not. Thank you, Ms. Kennedy. Okay, your time has expired, but you may have a minute.
I think I may.
All right. Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel, and again, an additional thanks, Mr. Gray, for accepting this appointment in this case. The court will take the case under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.